Welcome to Unspoken. Today I am really, really pleased to share that I am joined by Seetal Savla. Seetal is a fertility patient advocate, writer, and speaker. Having herself experienced multiple failed IVFs and losses before becoming mum to a daughter, she is passionate about sharing her story to support others and challenge stigma, particularly within the South Asian communities. Seetal is dedicated to creating space for honest, compassionate conversations around fertility, loss, and hope. Through her writing and advocacy, she helps others feel less alone in their journeys. So in today's episode, Seetal will be talking about her personal journey, but also how it can impact those from the South Asian community. It is a really touching and deep conversation. For this year's South Asian Heritage Month, we are really excited to be bringing you an event, Breaking the Silence, Fertility Journeys in the South Asian Community, on Tuesday the 5th of August from 5:30 p.m. at the Last Talisman in London. We will be hosting some incredible speakers on a panel event discussing topics from trying to conceive, living through baby loss, miscarriage and unsuccessful IVF, all the way through to navigating life without children. Details of how to book are in the show notes, and you can book via Eventbrite, and we hope to see you there. And I hope you find this episode useful. A warm, warm welcome to you, Seetal, and welcome to Unspoken. How are you today?
I'm really good, thank you, Anita, and thank you for having me. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Glad it's the weekend.
Very much so. Honestly, I had a very early start this morning and you can probably see on my face, you know, I'm a little bit tired, so ready for the weekend. It'll be a scorcher in Berlin, actually. So part of me is looking forward to that and part of me isn't. I'm not big on heat unless I'm on holiday by the pool or the beach with a cocktail, you know. Not the same when you're in a city, right?
Absolutely. And I know, obviously, we've been talking for a while and the thing that's brought us together is the topic of fertility. And I know you've been on your own journey. You're doing so much positive work in this space, but it'd be great if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do, why you do it, and also your story.
Yeah, of course. And it's really hard, as you'll know as well, just to condense years and years of history into a few minutes, but I always try my best. It started on Christmas Day 2015 when my husband and I discovered that we'd fallen pregnant naturally. And in that moment, I always thought that I would feel negative things because I had been on the fence about being a parent due to all the pressure that we got after, well, I should say I received after getting married. And it pushed me in the other direction. But actually, when I saw that positive test, I felt nothing but elation, and I just flashed forward 9 months, imagining everything to be as it should be. And sadly, that pregnancy ended really early. And as catastrophic as that was, it made me realize that I did want to become a mom. And so we realized we'd been married for 8 years, and that had been our sole pregnancy. We went to see our GP and had a year of fertility testing and waiting for results, investigations. And then we were referred for our first round of IVF on the NHS. When that was unsuccessful and we didn't qualify for any funding because I didn't have any extra embryos to freeze, we decided to go private. And we went to a clinic in central London, which is colloquially known as IVF boot camp. And it's a very intense place. We did 2 rounds there. They were also unsuccessful. And it was after that 3rd round that our then consultant suggested using donor eggs. And I immediately was interested in the idea. I was tired of trying and failing to conceive. And it just really, it was so grueling in every way. My husband needed a little bit more time. And so we decided to switch clinics to allow us to pursue donor conception, but also have a 4th and final round using my own eggs. And then when we finally started that, we had to hit pause because the world went into lockdown. And that was really frustrating. Just there's so much uncertainty in IVF as it is. And then you know, there's another element that's out of your control, and you're just waiting for news for the clinics to reopen while you're on Zoom calls with work, you know, people joking about COVID babies, and you're plastering on that brave face. Thankfully, I only had to wait a couple of months, and we then move forward with the cycle. Again, we chalked up another failure, and at that point, we decided to take stock, as we felt pretty bruised at this point, you know, physically and emotionally. And then we moved to Berlin. There was an opportunity through my husband's work, and it was throwing a spanner in the works, but I think we just really needed a change of environment. Nothing was really working out for us in London. And then we started donor conception. So our first cycle was, all the treatment was done in London. That was cancelled because they collected 15 unviable eggs. And that really shocked me. I wasn't expecting to hear that kind of news. You have such high success rates, and that's what was sold to us as well. And I know that there are different outcomes as well, but you have a lot more hope riding on this. And it was really difficult to accept that. That donor then didn't want to donate again so quickly. She had just had started a new job. So we had to find another one. We were very lucky to be matched with a second suitable donor and move forward with that. And that round was successful, which was really wonderful. But 2 months later, we had a miscarriage, and it was absolutely devastating. We'd finally got further than we ever had before. And to be told that there was no heartbeat, you know, you feel like just the bottom has come out of your world, you know, walking back out into the sunshine, everyone is happy, the world is carrying on, and you don't know what to do with yourself. And so at that point, we thought, well, just that's it, we need to take a proper break. We had two frozen embryos left. We weren't sure what to do, whether to try treatment, but we sort of both felt finished. I think we just needed to recover. And it was during this time that we somehow conceived naturally. And neither of us expected it to go very far because, you know, my pregnancies hadn't lasted beforehand. Yeah, it was somehow a straightforward pregnancy. And, you know, it was full of fear and anxiety, very much so at the beginning and all throughout, really. But I tried to embrace it as much as I could because I realized that was probably the only time that it would happen for me. My daughter was born happy and healthy 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago now. So it's pretty incredible. Whenever I tell that part of the story, it still feels very much surreal. Yeah. And in terms of why I share my journey and how I started talking about it, that goes back to 2019. And I had a food blog. So I was reviewing restaurants and interviewing chefs in London and around the world. But behind the scenes, I'd been going through loss and IVF. And yeah, it felt like I was living a double life. And so I'd gone to a retreat, and one of the classes had been an aerial yoga class. And I remember taking part in one of the moves, and I had this band going across my stomach, and it just really triggered me because I thought I shouldn't be able to do this. I shouldn't be able to lay flat on my stomach because I should be pregnant right now. And all of this is just wrong. And it just, the floodgates opened, and I was just in tears, surrounded by all these strangers, and I felt really vulnerable. And but actually, they couldn't have been more supportive, and it was really a really wonderful environment. And I was able to sort of lean into all of that sadness and heartbreak. And I decided to write about that when I came back to London. And the intention was never to publish it. I just needed to evacuate all those emotions onto paper. And then I showed it to my husband, and he said, actually, I think there's something there. You really should get that out there to support other people. And at the same time, we'd found out that one of his good friends had gone through IVF with his wife, and he hadn't told anyone, not even his parents. And I couldn't imagine how lonely that would be. We hadn't told the world by this stage, but you know, we had confided in our close family and friends, and they were a huge source of support. So I decided to publish it, and I was really afraid, actually, because I was worried about the pushback and the criticism and the judgment and people saying things like, you know, you're doing it for attention, or you're bringing shame on your family and the name, etc. But I knew I was doing it for the right reasons. And so I went ahead and published it, and the response was so positive. And that encouraged me to continue sharing my journey. And I shared a lot of it in real time, actually, documented that the first
Actually, no, which cycle was that now? Sorry.
There's been so much that it gets a bit confusing. But my last cycle, so the second donor IVF cycle, I documented for a video series in collaboration with a brand. So, you know, that it started out with writing that first blog post, but then I've written for magazines and newspapers, worked with brands on various awareness campaigns. I now work with Fertility Network UK for the online peer support groups. And I recently hosted my first loss circle in Berlin this week, which was a really positive experience, despite being a very heavy subject. And it was very powerful. And I hope to host more in the future as well. So yeah, it's a very exciting time to be trying different things, speaking at events, becoming a seminar host at the Fertility Show as well. And all of that is to help people who are going through fertility struggles, particularly people in South Asian communities where there's still so much shame and stigma surrounded by it. So, you know, if I'm able to share my voice and represent them in a little way, even though no two journeys are the same, then I feel very privileged to be able to do so.
Thank you. And I know it's not easy to recount and relive such traumatic experiences, and I really appreciate you being so open and honest. And I think what you've really described and painted is the roller coaster that people can go through when they're trying to conceive, going through fertility treatment. And it's the idea that IVF is the golden bullet, that it's, you know, that's going to result in a pregnancy. But what you're actually demonstrating is that so many different things can happen. And even when, like, you describe you're going through the egg donor process and there was a number of eggs that were not viable, that is just, it's just shocking. And it's, you know, each time you're getting the news of a miscarriage or a failed cycle, or, you know, your egg donor's eggs not being viable, that's a shock. That's a traumatic experience. And I'm just wondering how you manage and how you kept yourself going on such a difficult journey.
It is hard. And when you look back, you wonder how you did that, actually, because there are so many setbacks and, you know, feels like one step forward and five steps back. And I think at the beginning, you just have that optimism. You're a bit naive and you're going into it really with fresh eyes. And, you know, you've got all the stats and you're focusing on that positive aspect of it. And the longer you're on the journey, it becomes harder and harder to believe. And it's the hope and heartbreak cycle that really got me every time. So one cycle would fail and you're crushed, and it's just, you know, split second phone call or an email that you receive and, you know, I'm sorry, it hasn't worked this time. We'll set up an appointment, you know, the follow-up appointment to debrief and discuss the next steps. And you think, is that it? You know, all that money, all that effort, you know, all the injections and the procedures, and there's nothing at the end of it, but you just have to go again. And I don't know, I think taking time out, definitely talking to people who are able to hold that safe space for you. And that's one of the hardest lessons, I think. I tried to talk to everyone about everything once I did start sharing openly. And I realized that not everyone can sit there in that discomfort. Not everyone can hear what you have to say because it's uncomfortable, you know. And it's, you see someone in pain and you immediately just want to alleviate that and tell them it's going to be okay. And just hang in there and relax, stay strong, all of these things. But the more I heard that unsolicited advice, the more I just wanted to scream at people and say it's not easy. And you're navigating everything else around IVF. It becomes very all-consuming, but you also have work and you have other relationships and life goes on. But I found the TTC community somehow. It was one of those Instagram moments where you just go down the rabbit hole and one post leads to another. And that continues to give me a lot of support, just reading and listening to other people's stories and knowing that I wasn't alone. I just absorb them for a long time, actually, before engaging. So I didn't even like or comment on anything. And I remember listening to another fertility podcast and just crying and laughing in my living room, thinking, okay, I found my tribe and my people who finally get it. And, you know, it was such a relief to not feel so abnormal and alone. So for me, that was a great source of support. And then later down the line, I also sought therapy. And it took me a while to find the right therapist for me. Actually, it was only when I was going through my pregnancy, actually. Yeah, and it was pregnancy after, you know, when I was going through the loss that I decided to find a therapist from a South Asian background. And I wanted to try something different. And for some reason, I just felt ready for it. And I was lucky to find her. And it just made it easier to jump into those sessions, knowing that she understood the cultural concerns and that the challenges that we face on top of having to navigate all the issues surrounding IVF. So, yeah.
And I think you picked up on a key point, is that people struggle to sit in discomfort of someone else's experience, and they want to fix it, they want to give solutions, but sometimes it is that you just want someone to sit with you in your pain, and it's because you're carrying the grief, so, and it's a grief that you don't know what to do with, you don't know how to describe it or explain it, or even is it valid. So it's sometimes you just want people to sit with you and almost mourn your losses. And that can be so powerful.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's grief. It's disenfranchised grief, you know, losing. You lost so much that the loss of dreams, the loss of hope when you have a failed cycle, and people don't realize that actually. You just think, oh, well, throw more money at it and next time it'll work. My neighbor, my colleague, my cousin, so-and-so got pregnant after X amount of rounds. Just keep at it and it will work eventually. And when you say, you know, look, it's been four now, it's been five, it's been six, it's not working, you know, what do you suggest I do now? They don't know what to say. Yeah. And yeah, it's really hard. So I think I've learned to sort of separate the people who I can really go into detail with. I can just unravel and burden myself with, and it's okay. I won't be judged and I don't feel that there'll be any repercussions. And, you know, my best friend, she's not a mom. She's never really wanted to be a mom, but actually she's one of my biggest champions and sources of support after I found out that I'd had when the miscarriage happened. I just called her and we sat on the phone and, you know, I cried. She cried with me and it was just nice to be held in that way, even though we don't even live in the same country or the same city. And yeah, I feel very lucky to have that because I think that's what you need, just somewhere to be able to let out all that anger, the rage, the disappointment, the heartbreak, the sadness, you know. You don't just move on from something like that. And the longer you're on the journey, the more trauma you accumulate. And I didn't even realize that it was trauma because you think of that as big life incidents, you know, accidents and life-changing events like that. And I felt like a fraud when I had my first loss because it happened so early and there wasn't a lot of pain physically. But emotionally, it really did a number on me. And it was years and years later that I look back and go, okay, yeah, now I can, yes, that's what it is. It is trauma. And each setback just adds a little bit more to the account.
And again, I think a lot of people will underestimate how much it can impact you in terms of like feelings of depression, anxiety or trauma. And there is more coming into the space of highlighting some of that. But when you think back to when you were not getting what you needed, what would you have liked someone to say to you, even like a sentence or a couple of sentences? What do you think would have been a really powerful thing to say to you?
The word is gone.
Yeah.
It's so hard to answer these kind of questions, actually. It's like the one piece of advice that you'd give to someone going through the journey or just at the beginning of the journey. What would I like? It does depend on the circumstance, but if I'm to apply it to all general situations, probably just, I'm sorry you're going through this. Sometimes what else is there to say? And especially if you haven't been through it yourself. And even if you have, everyone's experiences are individual. I'm sorry you've been through this. Would you like to talk about it? How can I support you? What do you need? I think those kind of questions would be really nice to hear. And things are changing, but it takes a long time.
Yeah. And I think it goes to the point of people want to fix, but instead reverse it and ask what someone needs, because what you think they need might be something completely different. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important. And then going back to, you mentioned some of the unsolicited advice. Now, we're both from a South Asian background and we know there are lots of things that we might be told or hear about that's going to support us in getting pregnant. What are some of the things that were said to you that, in not necessarily from a bad place, but some things that the advice that was given to you?
been lucky to not have been on the receiving end of a lot of it. But at the beginning, I mean, it was just more general comments, you know, you're married, oh, it's been a year, it's been 2 years, you know, when are the babies coming? And, you know, you'll be too old soon. I mean, the most difficult one to stomach was just in a family setting, lots of people around, and then an elderly relative saying, you know, you better hurry up because your womb is going to shrivel up soon and then you won't be able to have kids, you'll be good for nothing. And that really hit hard. At that point, I wasn't even trying to conceive. And I look back and think, if I had, I'd been going through IVF and all the failures, that really would have cut deep. And I know where she was coming from, and she had a valid point. You know, there is a biological clock that we have to contend with, but there are softer, nicer ways to approach these scenarios when you're talking to people and you're dealing with a highly charged, you know, emotional situation. Now that I think about it, something else that popped into my mind, a friend of mine, we had a friend's weekend away. And at that point, we didn't have children. Everyone else did. And I turned up wearing a nice trench coat and heels and makeup and hair and all the rest of it. And one of my friends, a girl said, oh, it's all right for you. You don't have kids. You've got time to dress up and take care of yourself, you know. And I thought, well, yeah, that's not a very nice thing to say, is it? You know, I wouldn't say you look like this or like that because you've got kids and you haven't had the time. So, yeah, it felt very insensitive. And again, I wasn't trying to conceive then, but still it didn't feel good to hear that. But yeah, overall, it's comments like that, which I'm sure a lot of people listening will have had to hear.
Yeah. And like, there's so many things like at work, with amongst friends, amongst family. And it is like, people don't necessarily think or even mean it from a bad place, but it comes out and it can hit hard if someone's on a journey of trying to conceive. And I suppose where you've been so open with your own journey, have people come to you with their experiences from the South Asian community and kind of disclosed things that have been said to them or how they've been treated?
I think there are a lot of superstitions as well, especially if you've had loss and you're struggling to conceive and you're considered as being cursed. And you're not invited to events, especially baby showers and blessings, because they think that you'll pass that bad luck on to other women. And that's a very isolating place to be. It's not your fault at all. These are medical issues. And to be ostracized like that is really painful. And yeah, I can't even begin to imagine how hard that is to cope with on top of everything else as well. And, you know, this is, we always, I talk about this through a female lens, but men as well, you know, my husband's had to hear a few comments about, you know, things not working and getting checked out. And, you know, they're few and far between compared to what I've had to hear. But yeah, it's definitely something that needs to be brought out into the light a bit more, because yeah, there's a lot of focus on women going through fertility treatment. But often if, you know, if they're partnered, if they're married, then there is also someone else supporting them behind the scenes.
Yeah. And I think that as there's a lot of misconceptions that it's a female thing. Well, actually, it's typically around 40% is attributed to a male factor when there is a diagnosis of infertility. So I think, again, in the community, it's always put onto, or it tends to be put on to a woman. Yeah. And I suppose, what are some of the other nuances that you're aware of, experienced, heard about going through infertility within the South Asian community?
I think there's just a lot of expectation on us. We're just conditioned right from the beginning to want marriage and children, the big house, the great job. You know, there are a lot of tick boxes that we have to check. And if you don't, then you're made to feel like a failure. You know, marriage, motherhood, all of that is put on a pedestal. And I definitely felt while we were trying that I was inferior. And that really hurt, you know, because people didn't know. And once they did know what we were going through, it still didn't really stop them from making these comments, you know. And I think someone was saying to me once that they were moaning about getting pregnant in their 40s, like they'd had a couple of children already. And they said, oh, I wouldn't want to be doing that, you know, that late in my late 30s, early 40s. And you know, I was in that age bracket right then, and it just, you know, it took everything in me not to kind of say, this is not what I would have chosen for myself. You know, it took me time to realize life is not very linear for everybody.
And now, you know, this is the situation I find myself in, and I have to somehow, you know, do everything I can and hope for the best, really.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that tends to surface a lot in the community is shame. So it's a shame around, you know, this expectation that you haven't done something that you should have been doing, or the shame it can bring on your parents because they then have to, you know, outwardly face family and friends and feel that kind of the heaviness of something's not right with my child. And I know obviously that's a common thing, and not just for infertility, but I suppose it's something we do hear about quite a lot.
Yeah, there's such a pressure to be perfect, I think, isn't there? And it just, a lot of that goes back to, I think, the immigration story, our parents' immigration journey. And you come over to the UK, in our case, in my case, and, you know, you work really hard to give your children the opportunities that you never had, and you want them to get the jobs that will allow them to have that stable income and good career, good future, etc. You know, buy your home, feel rooted, have children continue the legacy. And, you know, it's, if you're unable to do that, you then take on that guilt and that shame because you haven't been able to honor their wishes. You know, you haven't been able to live up to their expectations. And even if there isn't an overt pressure, you can still feel that, I think, implicitly, and you can see it, you know, on their faces and read the emotions as well. And it's a lot to carry on top of everything else that comes up during treatment, I think. Yeah, it's very difficult. It's hard to explain this to other people as well, I think. You know, it's not exclusive to the South Asian community, but I definitely think, you know, with ethnic minority communities and with backgrounds and, you know, colonialism, all of this weighs heavy on us.
And I imagine there are going to be people listening who are potentially from a South Asian background and in a situation where they feel like they're carrying that guilt, the shame of firstly not being able to conceive, but secondly the impact it might be having on parents and in-laws. I suppose, is there any words of advice you'd give to someone that could be of comfort or help them through that?
I always want to tell people that you're not alone, even though it really feels that way sometimes. And now that I find myself doing this advocacy work, I've built up a really nice support network for myself. And even then, there are moments where I feel incredibly lonely. In those challenges, you know, both while I was trying to conceive and now that I'm a mother as well, everything that comes along with that. And that's another aspect of it. You know, if you are lucky to bring a baby home after all of this, the trauma doesn't end, the challenges don't end, and you carry that with you. And I think people just expect all of that to disappear and life to be rosy once your dreams have come true. And that's not the case at all. And it's very difficult to talk about that because you feel so ungrateful. And I still carry a sense of survivor's guilt, if you will, about the way my daughter was conceived after everything, because I know how people are struggling. I have been one of those people. I was one of those people. And, you know, why me? Why not someone else? You know, and it's having those, living with those emotions, and they can all coexist, you know, the joy, the grief, the sadness and the guilt, you know, and trying to let go of the things that don't serve you so much. So yes, you're not alone. And also seek support, whatever that looks like for you. For some people, that would be just confiding in a trusted person, whether that's friends, family, a colleague, whoever, or support groups online, being anonymous, and, you know, you can engage with them as much as or as little as you want. And if means allow, if the opportunity allows, to speak to a professional as well. I think even though you can have people around holding that space for you, there's nothing quite like speaking to someone who is completely unrelated and really not involved in your life. And for me especially, I can just go there and unburden myself, let it all out without feeling bad that I'm taking up too much time and I should be asking about their life, etc. And then they can also help you, guide you, give you the tools you need to cope with these difficult moments that we come across. But there is just much support. That's what I want people to know. And it's available in so many forms.
Absolutely. And the what you described as, you know, there's various options, and to get, I think, build a community, not feel alone, have a sense of belonging, know that, you know, there's others who are on a similar journey, and it's, you know, the emotions that you are feeling, it can be validating to know that other people feel grief or sadness or anger, because it is so isolating if you don't feel like you can talk to someone. And I suppose the thing that took me a while to realize is that it's, you know, I don't have the shame to carry, because I didn't choose to, you know, not be able to conceive or have to go through IVF treatment and loss and everything. So I think it's for people to recognize that actually it's not your fault. Absolutely not, because no one would choose for this to happen. And I think to develop some of that self-compassion.
And chances are you'll be made to feel like it's your fault because you left it too late, or you did something wrong in a past life, or I don't know, there are so many reasons why you have some bad thoughts, or, you know, there are so many superstitions that people have to contend with, and it's just, it's not fair. You know, and maybe male factor hasn't been investigated. Maybe it's not you, and that's not to blame the male partner, but it's complex and it's not black and white. And I really want people to realize that.
Yeah. And if there was a, you know, a formula for getting pregnant, that person would be very, very rich right now. But an IVF is only a fraction of helping. And it's, that's why it's assisted reproduction. So it's not, you know, going to give you that necessary, the outcome. And I know you talk about this is it's what happens when IVF donor conception doesn't work. And yeah, just to get your thoughts on that.
It's really hard, because even ahead of the first cycle, you know, I knew the chances are were very slim of conceiving the first time round. But I had a friend I worked with, and she got lucky. She did one round. She had her son. And I thought, well, if that happened to her, why shouldn't it happen to me? You know, I'm in good health and we're with a good clinic. And I mean, I wasn't young. I was in my mid-30s, but still I wasn't over the hill by that point. And when it didn't work, I was just crushed. And it's hard to, we had to then change clinics, and you have to, we went from NHS to private, which was a completely different environment. And the clinic I was in, you know, I felt like a walking credit card. You know, it's just a revolving door. And, you know, you want to be valued as a person, as a patient, as someone going through an incredibly difficult time. And, you know, it's just the information is thrown at you. And I was very overwhelmed, actually. And so, yeah, that might be another piece of advice that I would give to people starting out, that, well, something I wish I had done myself is to try and advocate more for myself, inform myself more, and take control of my journey. It took me, I think it was only until the third round, yeah, that I started to feel like I was in the driving seat. Up until that point, I was very much backseat, just autopilot, you know, tell me where to go and when, and I'll just turn up and you do what you need to do. You know, I completely disassociated. And the longer I was on the journey, then I got familiar. I started getting involved with the TTC community. I started attending events and open days, etc. And I thought, okay, this is my story. And it's time to lead and ask questions. And no question is stupid. And if they make me feel stupid, then it's not the right place for me.
Yeah, you're so right.
I think I digressed a little there.
No, and I think my journey also started in 2015. So back then it was very much everything was behind closed doors. Whereas now you've got so many things online, you've got people sharing their stories, you've got Instagram accounts, you've got so many different resources. And that kind of takes me to the South Asian support group. So within Fertility Network, and it's something that I started back in 2016 because I recognised there wasn't anything around. And now, you know, you're leading that group. And how has that been for you? And what do you think is the importance of that?
Thank you very much for starting that. You know, I'm sure you've helped so many people as well just by creating that space and allowing to come as they are and say what they need to. I have been doing that for about 4 months now, actually, and I really enjoy it. Just it's an intimate circle, talking to people, meeting them where they're at on their journey and hearing about their experiences. And it's, you know, it's a real privilege because they're sharing such private things with me, things that they might not have shared with other people in their lives. And one thing that's really surprised me is that I had this perception that, you know, in-laws, parents, for the most part, are not supportive. Like they try to be, but then they come out with all that unsolicited advice that we talked about, well-meaning, but, you know, dismissive ultimately. But, you know, I've heard, and it's been encouraging to hear, that actually that's not the case for a lot of people. And the parents are wanting to learn and be there in a different way, show up differently for their children, their in-laws. And I think that's really wonderful. It's great for breaking all those intergenerational trauma patterns. I'm really stumbling over my words today.
It's Friday.
It is, indeed. But yeah, it's great. I am enjoying the experience, and I would love to continue that. And it's been great bringing guest speakers on as well to cover different perspectives. So, fertility doctors, and then advocates like myself. And the first guest speaker was Aisha, who went through 10 years of trying to conceive and ended the journey without a baby. And now she talks so passionately about life on the other side. And I'm really grateful to her voice, because as we've been saying, it's an aspect that you don't hear too much about, because everybody just, you know, wants the baby at the end, which is understandable. But what about when that doesn't happen? We need to talk about that more, so that people aren't left feeling like there's something wrong with them. And, you know, they didn't try, they didn't want it enough. It's not that easy. It's not the case. And we all have different thresholds as well. You know, for some people, they don't want to do IVF whatsoever. And that doesn't mean that, you know, it wasn't hard to let go of that dream. And for others, you know, it will take a few cycles and then they're done.
Yeah. And I suppose the thing, especially if you're starting out on your journey, you can't imagine not having a baby at the end, or you can't imagine giving up hope or just, you know, drawing a line. But I suppose the thing that I would say is that just know your own threshold. You don't want to burn yourself out, you know, damage yourself physically, mentally. And it's about knowing, actually, yes, there's going to be a process of grief when you come to the end. But, you know, two things can coexist. You can be sad, but you can also find joy in life. And that's what you hear a lot from people who've come out the other end, like Aisha, that, you know, there is life after fertility treatment.
Yeah, and that's the community that I turned to towards the end, when we were deciding what to do with our embryos. And I needed hope to come in a different form. It started out with the success stories, in inverted commas. Don't really like to label them that way, but, you know, the stories that ended with a baby. And then I needed to know that, yeah, I would be okay. You know, I tried, we did everything we could, and, you know, we will find joy elsewhere. And maybe that's not what everybody wants to hear, but it was definitely, yeah, the right approach for us. And in the end, with the embryos, we decided to donate them. We tried to donate them to another couple, but in the end, the donor withdrew her consent. So we donated them to our clinic for training purposes. But a whole bit that I skipped over earlier in my intro was that we didn't use a South Asian donor. And that probably needs a separate conversation. So that's quite a rare road to walk down as a South Asian couple. And we decided to stay in the UK for our treatment. And we went with a British Ecuadorian donor and a British Spaniard as well, because the phenotyping is quite similar. The physical characteristics will be similar.
And thank you for sharing that. And I know for many, the prospect of going down the donor conception route, be it a donor egg, donor sperm, can feel like impossible. But what are some of the things that might help people in that journey of getting to that decision? Because obviously, you know, the stats show that is increased chances of a pregnancy and a live birth. So what do you think might help people in making those decisions?
I think there are a lot of resources, and you can seek out Instagram accounts, people talking about their own experiences. And for me, that was very helpful, just to see that play out in real life, hear about the fears that they had, the grief of losing their genetics, and the challenges they faced before and after their children conceived and after they came into the world. And that helped me to feel more confident in my decision. For me, I didn't really feel any of that grief. It was more just, I wanted to become a mum. And if I was still able to carry the pregnancy, then, you know, with epigenetics and everything, more information becoming available on that front, I thought I would pass something on, and I would be raising the child. So I would see myself as the mother. What I hadn't considered, and what came to light after my daughter was born, was the number of comments on appearance. And you know, people saying, oh, she looks like your husband. I had a lot of those at the beginning and it irritated me because I felt erased out that whole process. I thought, I just spent 9 months carrying this child and I just birthed this child. You know, I would like some recognition as well too, you know, and I want to see myself in her. And then the next thought was, well, if she'd been donor conceived, that would be even harder to accept, I think, and hear. And how would I navigate that? Would I feel the need to tell people every time, wait a second, you know, this is how we did it. And, you know, let me educate them, use it as an opportunity. Or do I just step back and suck it up and go, yeah, it's not the right moment. But it's a very personal decision. And there are lots of factors to consider as well. Do you want an anonymous donor, non-anonymous donor? Do you want to tell your child? Do you want to tell your wider circle? How will you go about doing that? And then do you want to go for treatment in the UK or abroad? And then ethnicity as well. You know, for us, like I said, it wasn't a make or break. And, you know, if you prefer to have a South Asian donor, which is completely valid and understandable, there's a lengthy wait list in the UK. And a lot of the time you don't have that time to play with, actually. You want to get to the end of your journey. You want to hold your baby. And so if you go abroad, it can be cheaper. It can be faster as well, and you can have that you can have an anonymous donor too, although laws are changing all the time. But it really depends what matters to you. So I would say that even though you feel like you need to rush through everything, try and, you know, take a beat and just decide what matters to you and where the best place is to go for that. I think if I had my time again, I would seriously consider going abroad. We had quite a few unforeseen complications, you know, with COVID, and then there was just such a long wait to be matched, and then we moved and that didn't help. And so after the first cycle was cancelled, you know, I had a lot of thoughts about, God, we should have just, you know, gone to Spain or to Portugal and, you know, gone with anonymous. You know, why was I so determined to have a non-anonymous donor? And it took a lot of strength, you know, and it reminding myself that there is a reason why that was important to us, to be able to give the donor's information to any child that we had. But nowadays there are a lot of options and a lot of clinics abroad, and you know, they speak great English as well, so you're not necessarily navigating that language barrier either, and different treatments and also a change of scenery. Sometimes I think if you don't wish to disclose to people that you're going through this going abroad, you can sort of say it's just a bit of a holiday for a week or so. Mm-hmm. And that way you also have a change of scenery as well.
Yeah. And any good clinic, be it in the UK or abroad, they will have wraparound services to support people going on that journey. So they offer things like counselling and, you know, just again, like you were saying, do your own research and make sure you feel comfortable with the clinic, with the process, with everything. And that's so important because it's a big commitment and it's, you know, it's something huge to consider. And I could talk to you for hours, Zito. You're so
a lot to say about everything. Yeah,
there's a lot. Yeah, there's so much we could unpick.
I have been able to transform this pain into my purpose. You know, I'm a passionate fertility patient advocate now, and with all of the work that I do, honestly, it brings me a lot of joy to be able to support people and educate people as well, as much as I can do, even though there's always so much more to be done. But, you know, I think every voice helps, and you never know who is watching and seeking comfort from you. A lot of people will never message and reach out to let you know, actually. And so when I have my moments of thinking, you know, am I making an impact, then, you know, I remind myself of that.
Absolutely. And that's the reason why we connected, because I saw on Instagram you'd share your story, being so open. So that's, you know, where we connected. So, and I hear that a lot where I've shared my journey. People have said later down the line, by the way, your story helped me feel seen, less alone. And I think that goes a long way in supporting people, because we know what it feels like and how difficult it could be.
And it's really encouraging to see a lot more, just one last thing actually, yeah, to see more conversations about fertility in the workplace. A lot of companies are focusing on that, and it's great because it makes all the difference to know that you're supported and seen and heard and appreciated, and not have to worry about your career being affected alongside going through all of these difficult challenges. And I think the only time that I felt really a bit on edge about it and a bit nervous was when I started my job in Berlin, and that first week coincided with my transfer back in the UK, and having to tell my manager, okay, I know that I've just started and you need me to be all hands on deck, but I'm going to have to go back to the UK and I'll try and be as available as much as I can. But I didn't say it was for IVF. Everything was open at that point. I don't know if my manager had looked at my social media feeds, but I'd said I was going back to do this. But the official reason was just medical treatment that needs to be done in the UK. And she was extremely supportive. And when I went through the miscarriage as well, I couldn't have asked for someone to hold my hand better than she did. And, you know, just take everything, all the work stuff off the table, no pressure, just, you know, try and put a handover together. But if you can't, I'll figure it out. You just take the time you need. We won't even go through HR, no official channels. Just you keep me posted and I want you to be well. And I think that's what everyone needs to hear, because, you know, there's so much going on in your head and your heart. And then to have to worry about work and protecting what you've built, your relationships and your projects and everything, you know, your career, you know, it's too much.
Yeah. And again, it goes back to the employer just being able to say, what do you need right now? And mm-hmm. taking the stress and the pressure away, giving you the flexibility. Those are all really key things that can help anyone on their journey.
Definitely.
And before we finish, it will be, if there was one thing that you would say to yourself, if you were to go back to the start of your journey, what is the one thing that you would say to yourself or anyone else about to embark on a journey? What would be your one bit of advice?
First thing that came to mind was just, you're stronger than you think. Even in those vulnerable, lonely moments, you know, you've got this. Yeah, I often, there was that whole coffee with my younger self trend, and, you know, I wrote something about that as well. Just, I wish I could go back in time and give myself a big hug, you know, the girl who was going to embark on her first round of IVF. And it was just, I was so overwhelmed, honestly. I can't even explain, just it was all too much, all the medical jargon and having to inject myself. I remember when we received all the syringes and the drugs and the needles, and I unpacked them in our spare room and I just broke down and thought, what are we doing? Like, this is too much. How am I supposed to inject myself? Maybe it's not meant to be, you know, it's not too late to back out. And yeah, it'll be nice to just sit down on the floor with that girl and say, you know what, it's going to be a really hard journey and there will be some beautiful moments throughout. You will connect with people, you will help people, and it will all go so differently to the way that you'd envisaged, but it will unfold the way it needs to. And I'm not a very spiritual person generally, so I hear myself saying that and part of me, my younger self, is cringing, but I am leaning into spirituality a little bit more and believing that, you know, this is the way it was meant to be. I sometimes, you know, when I'm having difficult phases and I think, God, I really should have started sooner. You know, I'm in my early 40s and I have a toddler and, you know, our friends have got 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, and we're sort of out of sync with them. But, you know, it happened the way it happened. And, you know, I'm very grateful that she's here now and that I'm able to use my experiences to support other people.
And thank you for that. And I think I can speak for many others as well, that you, just by being open, sharing a story, sharing advice, I know it would have touched so many lives and helped so many people along the way. So thank you for that. And thank you for your continued support. And I think, yeah, your advice, what you've given, is really important. It's, yeah, take care of yourself as well along the journey.
Yeah, exactly. Life does go on. It doesn't feel like that. It's very all-consuming, as we said earlier, but try to create moments of joy. The glimmers that we talk about a lot online, just, you know, take little moments for yourself. You know, when you go to appointments, you know, I used to take myself for a coffee or a nice solo lunch and just, you know, have a little walk in Marylebone and, you know, try and be in the present as much as possible to take my mind off, you know, those heavy feelings.
Definitely. Such an important conversation, and just want to say a huge, huge thank you, Seetal, and I hope and I know that a lot of people will find this helpful. So thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
A huge, huge thank you to Seetal for being so open and so honest. And I think for me, what really shone through was her empathy. And having been on her own journey, she really understands the nuances within the South Asian community and, you know, still does so much work in this space to support others and now leads the South Asian Support Group Free Fertility Network. You can find more details of the support group on the Fertility Network website at fertilitynetworkuk.org. And you can also join the closed Facebook group to find out more details about upcoming meetings and connect with others. If you found this episode difficult in any way, there are details in the show notes of where you can access support. And there is also details about where you can find Seetal if you'd like to find out more about her work. And we are thrilled that season two is sponsored by Tambre, a leading assisted reproduction center based in Madrid. Tambre believes that fertility care should be both advanced and deeply human. We hope you found this episode useful. And don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. We look forward to bringing you more episodes in the future. Stay well.